in this episode.
Why are you making a second sequel to that Revenge of the 80s Kids thing? Because it's a franchise that should never have existed.
No, this is Exhibit A in that argument, I think.
Every week you have something where it's a problem that seems intractable, and then they tract the intractable problem.
And just a jumble of things seemingly sewn together with no idea what the word cohesion or logic might mean.
Because on the one hand, it's all, I'm a teenager who likes to go to parties. On the other hand, it's like, hail Satan. No, really, hail Satan.
But oh well, small sacrifices.
If we're going to do that conversation, yeah, absolutely.
What we get is Wizard Thunderdome. Two wizards enter, one wizard leave, and they literally just out-magic each other until one dies by just zap.
But the Smurfs got beaten out by a bunch of drunk dudes who can't remember what happened yesterday. I'm not getting involved with this. Having said that, I've watched it because I hate them little blue guys.
Which is why I quite like it as well.
And the Butt Monkey is never going to want to undergo any experience like that again in his life.
It's a long con, but it's a long con with some sort of Banana Republic somewhere, isn't it?
It's so weird. It's like the weirdest. It's surreal.
You just have to accept that Tom Cruise is one of the most amazing human beings. He's a superhero level man.
No, no, stop. Stop right there. Even if it's not over, it blooming well should be.
I love house elves. My uncle's a house elf.
Leo.
Ian, I have a problem. We're about to spend two whole shows talking about 2011, and you know how much I've been looking forward to this. Because, yeah, okay, so back in 2008, we got to talk about the MCU a bit, and then in 2010, Iron Man 2 was out, so obviously we got to talk about that, because it was in the top 10. And I was just looking forward to a little chat about my buddies, you know, my bros, Thor and Captain America. Turns out that not only did they not really have anything to do with the 80s, but they're not in the top 10 either. So how are we going to get this discussion in?
I'm sure you'll find some way to crowbar in some discussion of Marvel.
Well, of course, yes. I think that probably the best angle to take would be to point out that back in 2011, people didn't know. I have actually come to the thought on this that Iron Man 2 made the top 10 in 2010, and Avengers, I haven't looked yet, because 2012, we're not covering that till like next Easter, but I'm pretty sure that Avengers was quite high up there in the top 10 for 2012. So my belief is that people actually got familiar with Thor and Captain America as movies following the Avengers, and that people kind of viewed the Avengers as a sort of Iron Man 3 in the wider public, because they'd obviously been to see Iron Man quite a bit up to that point. So, you know, Robert Downey Jr. suddenly becomes a lot more key to the early success. I mean, people have always said that, but this really brings it home. Because Thor, I believe, made about $300 million. And Captain America, $400 million. Might be the other way around. And the lowest entry on 2011's top 10 made $500 million. So it just, I think that means that people didn't, although they were fine, and people did, you know, obviously they did fine, they've got sequels. I mean, what's really interesting is that the Captain America part, as we shall see, became a like a keystone of the, like, going forward. Thor, well, he's got Ragnarok, isn't he? So, you know.
Well, I think, we're talking about the MCU, everybody. How'd this happen? Well, you know, the thing about Thor is it did set up who the villain was going to be for the Avengers movie, as well as the... Yeah.
So I've got this picture of people like scrambling, like, who's this guy? Oh, he's in Thor. Oh, I never bothered to go and watch that. And then off they go to watch Thor. Sorry, carry on.
Well, everyone knew it was building. I mean, you know, as we were going into it, we were going, oh, yeah, that Tesseract's going to be in the Avengers movie. Oh, that's Loki. He's going to be the main villain in the Avengers movie. And, you know, even Captain America had ended with, what he called? One-eyed man.
Nick Fury.
Sort of coming in, recruiting him. Oh, and that turned out to be a scene in the Avengers. Wasn't that awesome, everybody?
Yeah, it's so. I mean, yeah. I mean, the point is that those in the know. I mean, 300 million. There's nothing to sniff at. And at this stage, 2011, we're still only 3 years into their great project. So, you know, I mean, it's. I think. Obviously, everybody was perfectly happy, and I think they always knew Thor was going to be a tough sell. And I think the other thing that they always knew was that Captain America, like, who cares about Captain America in the modern age? How are they going to sell that? And I think people have a lot of residual affection for that movie, but we'll maybe move on from that because that's not what we're here to talk about. So,
I was just going to say, you know, talking about, you know, they were not in the top 10 this year. We've just had, you know, Ant-Man the Wasp, which is considered to be the lowest tier of Marvel movie we had this year, one that might even be said by some to be performing under expectation slightly. But that was still 600 million, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that's... I mean, yeah, if we're going to do that conversation, yeah, absolutely. Ant-Man underperformed... I think it underperformed for pundits. I don't think that anyone at Marvel Studios was like, yeah, that underperformed. If you look at the actual movie, it's like for the first Ant-Man, a nice little throwaway piece of action entertainment that's going to go nicely into your box set and on your shelf along with the rest. It gives you a little bit of added value to the Avengers Infinity War. It made them a bunch of money. Everybody wins with Ant-Man and the Wasp. So it didn't make Black Panther money, but they didn't even expect Black Panther to make Black Panther money. So what the hell? Let's move on from that right away because we're here to talk about 2011.
We are, and we're here to do the top 10. And really, Leo, I have a problem.
Which is what?
I survey this list, and I laid down the hypothesis. The 80s influence couldn't be further away this year.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the interesting things. It's top 10 is going to be not 80s based at all. And after, I mean, the thing is, the year before, as we recall, some of the stuff in there had some kind of, this is where people were making a clean break. But we still got, one of the things that I noticed that's a theme from 2010 that comes forward here is they love the kids movies. And franchises as well. Franchises and kids' movies. That's what we're talking about for the next, you know, 45 minutes or so. So
well, this is part of the great era where everyone was complaining that everything was a franchise movie, everything was a sequel of something else, and there's no original ideas anymore.
And our top 10 is not going to dissuade anyone from that view.
No, this is Exhibit A in that argument, I think.
Yeah. At the bottom of the list... Pixar's at that time, Pixar's nadir. I think they might have gone lower than this right now. Certainly in financial terms, but also I think Cars 2 wasn't like something that people were a big fan of even at the time. But it still made $500 million globally. So you know how much
what
of a
story behind this film was it? A case of they thought it was really good, so they made it. Was it just a cash in?
Oh, this
it followed
is a cash-in.
Really hard on. It followed fairly quick on the first Cars film, as far as I know. And then everyone was surprised, oh, they made a sequel to this, but apparently it must have done well with some...
The toys, the merchandise, the little boys. My little boy hasn't quite got to the age, but he will. He knows who Lightning McQueen is. He doesn't even watch... He's kind of paid half an eye to 1 and 3, you know... Occasionally.
All right. So
he's aware and it's going to come in. But yeah, little boys of a certain age loved that and loved the merchandise. And Disney were like, you've got to make a sequel to this. And they're like, well, we don't really do sequels. And they go, well, you can make some other sequels, maybe to stuff that we weren't going to give you budget for. I think, you know, Cars 2 is why we have Monsters U. Because although Monsters Inc. performed fine, I don't think anyone was like, let's have a sequel to Monsters Inc.
It was a prequel, so there we go, subverted expectations. Nevertheless, Cars 2, Disney want to cash in, and they duly get it, plus extra merchandising on top. I imagine they're very happy with the project.
What's very interesting about it is that Cars is obviously Doc Hollywood with a car. Spoilers for anyone who's not seen Cars. Cars 3 is like a... They've gone right with Cars 3 into the sort of... This is a sports movie where the guy's getting old and is it... You know, it's like a sort of a Rocky sequel without the brain damage and with... Although, I mean, Owen Wilson's doing the voice, so sometimes it's hard to tell. Maybe Lightning Queen took too many dings to the Raid Defender. Anyway, but yeah, but this Cars 2 in the middle is a James Bond movie, which is really weird.
Well, James Bond had his gadget cars. That's the thing. Well,
that's how it worked. That's what they thought. That's the angle they took. They were like, okay, we're going to make a sequel to Doc Hollywood with a car. What are we going to do? Well, we've got a world full of cars. Let's do a spy movie. To be fair, it's obvious that Cars 2 is pretty lazy. But having said that, I've watched it. It's perfectly acceptable. And I think there were some adults, reviewers, in fact, probably Mark Kermode, that complained it was way too complicated for a kid's movie. The plot was like it was going to go watch over that, and they didn't realise that the point was that Pixar knew what they were making this for, which was for the DVD shelf, and it didn't matter if kids didn't get it when they saw it at the cinema, because like they were just excited to be seeing another Cars movie. What was going to be interesting was that over years the cruft of, like, you could take any kid of that generation, someone who was like 7 or 8 in 2011, and so he's coming up to 20 now, say, explain the plot of Cars 2 to me, and they will tell you, even though it'll take them 5 minutes, they'll tell you what the plot is because they've seen it a billion times by this point, so you know it's fine. What might surprise people is that what beat Cars 2 in top 10 is the reboot of The Smurfs, about which I can say nothing because I hate them little blue guys. I hated them in this one. I hated them in that grittier reboot that James Cameron did. And I think, you know, and this reboot followed very hard on the heels of that one. So, you know, you can see it, but yet people seem to respond to it more. It's a little bit like that whole Spider-Man thing, where they rebooted Spider-Man and people didn't like it, so they gave it back to Marvel for a bit and rebooted it again. I managed to get Marvel in again.
So, yeah, this confused me, because Smurfs are one of those things where everyone knows what they are, but I thought part of the joke was no one actually went to go see these things.
But apparently more people went to it, only by about $1 million worth of ticket sales, by the way. So it didn't really beat Cars 2 by much. But I bet that Columbia lorded that one up.
Yeah, actually, I thought about the Smurfs, because obviously you put down who was the distributor for the film.
Yeah.
Columbia. I thought Smurfs Columbia. Did Smurfs go to Columbia? That's an interesting take on things.
I should learn commas on these lists, shouldn't I?
Or brackets, parentheses, please. Yes, I'm not sure what we can say, really. Smurfs was one of those things we saw. It was some sort of European cartoon that was on our television, and it was a sure sign that we needed to turn over.
Yeah, so there we go. But apparently that didn't happen this year. I'll be interested to follow, because they got some sequels, obviously. Well, who's going to beat Cars 2 with a Smurfs movie and not go, I guess we'll greenlight a sequel? So I'll be interested to see how that goes from now on, or maybe I won't. I'm not going to seek it out. But if it turns up in the top 10 again, I'm certainly going to be like, Smurfs. Who knew? Here's an interesting one at 8, or at least one that, yeah, at least we could have a conversation about this a bit more, or maybe we can. At number 8, beating those two by another $3 million. The increments at this point in the bottom part of the top 10 are very small. But the Smurfs got beaten out by a bunch of drunk dudes who can't remember what happened yesterday in The Hangover Part 2. Which is actually, I mean, it was a bit of a benchmark because comedy sequels were like that, still clinging on to that thing where if you make a comedy sequel, it's a law of diminishing returns. And The Hangover was like the keystone in this big summer comedy push that's been happening in the last few years of the 2000s. And they still kind of, I think it's kind of over now. Well, our recent review of the year says even if it's not over, it well should be, because nobody's really, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, everybody.
Yes,
it has to be a surprise.
Well, I have to confess, I haven't seen Hangover Part 2, but I'm told it's a laudable remake of the first Hangover film, which everyone complained bitterly about at the time. And so they went to do something completely different with Hangover Part 3, and people were even more upset about that. So yeah, at least what can we say about this Part 2?
Hangover Part 2 goes to Saw movie levels of trying to wriggle around why this one, because after the first one, in which there was a guy, obviously you're going to make a film about a hangover where people wake up and there's like a leopard in the bathroom and all of this kind of stuff, where they work out what happened the night before. One of those characters, when you're doing the writing for this, be the butt monkey. And the butt monkey is never going to want to undergo any experience like that again in his life. And sure enough, although they have to cast the actor and have him included, and he is part of the whole experience, he is like, I am not drinking at all. I don't care. So they have to go to these enormous lengths to work out how it is he ends up, you know, in that Die Hard, two Die Harder, how can the same stuff happen to the same guy twice thing. And that's like, it's the thing that, actually, to be fair, that is the thing that remains with me most about Hangover Part 2, is the lengths they went to explain how it is that this guy, who was traumatized enough the first time, ended up back in that particular, you know, in that particular situation again. Ridiculous. So, yeah, it was perfect.
I don't think they needed to overthink it particularly. I think the world is full of people who wake up one morning and go, that's it, I'm never drinking again, and cut to next weekend. And
it wasn't so much the never drinking again. It was just the traumatic thing of having a blackout and waking up with no tooth and Mike Tyson's leopard in your bathroom and all of this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, that character was really like, no, absolutely not, I'm not getting involved with this. And a lot of the dialogue in the film is spent on explaining how it is that he allows the same sorts of things to happen to him a second time. So,
well, he certainly learned his lesson by the third film.
Well, yes, certainly he had. I mean, the other thing that they'd got for Part 3, which they kind of had for the first two, and indeed Crazy Rich Asians, is Ken Leong, who seems to be the box office paragon of making a lot of money out of a cheap comedy. So yeah, that's he's always got that. So then we start to get into a bit of a bigger jump, not much of a bigger jump, but sufficiently. At the moment, we have the sequel to the reboot, which is the fourth sequel to Fast and the Furious. The movie franchise once described by other Justin as a bit of a chav franchise. Fast Five, Vin Diesel, The Rock, Paul Walker, for It Is He, and all of those guys in Fast Five. I'm presuming you haven't seen this.
This is the one Fast and Furious film that I have seen.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
If this is the one where they're dragging a safe around the streets, I've seen it.
I believe so. I can't remember. I haven't really watched them back. At some point, I want to cram in Fast 8, which is on... because I'm fascinated by the franchise. Because it's a franchise that should never have existed. Like, when they did Tokyo Drift as a sort of perfunctory, really, this should go straight to DVD, you know, it's in that American Pie, Naked Mile area. It should never have gone on to, and then we get all the original actors back to do, you know, Fast and Furious, which is curiously, I mean, they didn't even call it Fast and Furious, just to say, you know, like, although it is the fourth movie in the franchise. At that point, I think everybody was like, they're doing this. And Fast Five is the one where, like, even they were surprised by Fast and Furious and the fact that it made bank. So Fast Five is the more assured one. But what they did take away from this, I think, is... there's not a lot of being fast in it. I mean, Furious, fine. But you've called it Fast Five, but Fast is, you know, it's got as many car chases as any other action movie. But and that's the point. I mean, part of the point of the franchise, the thing that I glom onto for the gloriousness, is this idea that it all takes place in this fantasy world where street racing is far more important than it in fact is. The first one doesn't take place in that world. The first one's like a tabloid rip-off. And the second one, in fact. And the third one. There you go, three movies of just, yeah, street racing, that's a thing. And then the fourth one is where they actually start to go, street racing's a thing, and all the people who do it are like secret agents or something. And you're like, no, stop. Stop right there. But in fact, they did. Eventually, they managed to glom the two strands of the franchise together into this, like, yes, there's street racing, but there's also secret agent. I mean, by number seven, they've actually got, like, a big room with computer screens on the wall, and they do, like James Bond-esque, and then we'll come to this intersection at this point, blah, 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 and they intercut it with the job that they're doing, like they're some kind of weird federal department. It's so weird. It's, like, the weirdest. It's surreal. It takes place in a... Right. Fast Five and, well, Fast and Furious 6, 7, 8... have more in common with Lord of the Rings than they do with anything that happens in the real world. So there we go.
It is a marvel that this thing has so come to dominate in our more latter days. It is a behemoth franchise that seemingly cannot fail and will never die.
It's because there's a... It exemplifies a part of cinema. Your point is, if you want to watch something that's kind of clever, that's going to absorb you and make you think, and you know, like, people used to have water cooler movies. Like, you know, you get One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and people bemoan the fact that this kind of movie doesn't get made anymore. One Flew Over, even as far as where they fail utterly to actually be in any way water cooler worthy, such as that film we saw together, Disclosure. Yeah. People used to make movies like that where people just... Now people make movies like that by accident as a byproduct of what they're trying to do in the cinema, which is give people a popcorn munching night out at the cinema or win an Oscar. Those are the two reasons you make a movie. You either want to win an Oscar or you want to blow people's minds with special effects. And the Fast and Furious franchise is... like the McDonald's of movies. Like, anyone who goes to see one is just expecting to see cars being driven fast, gleaming muscles, maybe a few women in bikinis, and pretty cars. That's all they're expecting to see, which is why 4 and 5 kind of, because it doesn't quite adhere to the formula quite hard enough, but then they restore the thing for later on. And
It's a gorgeously blokey franchise as well. It has very few pretensions, which is why I quite like it as well.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what my thing. It's completely unpretentious, and I kind of like it on a meta level of just like, yeah, you do you, Fast and Furious, you do you. So this is them doing them, but they still got beaten by Jack Black voicing a martial arts fan panda. I mean, look, we've had three
for the second time it's Kung Fu Panda 2.
Yeah, Kung Fu. Right, I happen to know quite a bit about Kung Fu Panda, as it happens, because me and Dylan have a thing. He's kind of going through a phase of not really, because there's a phase where you can just watch the funny animals talking to one another and doing martial arts. Then there'll be a phase where you actually understand the dialogue and go, oh, that's funny. But he's in between those two phases now. But when he was just learning to eat, like, oh, panda, like that. So we watched all the Kung Fu Pandas. One of the maddening things about Kung Fu Panda 2 is the fact that, like many animation movies, it doesn't have a credit sequence at the beginning. And so, you know, you're like, oh, there's Jack Black and there's Dustin Hoffman and there's all the people that you're with. And the villain comes on and you're like, I know who that is, but I don't know who it is. Who is this crane who is doing, or whatever he was, or swan, or he's come some kind of bird anyway, who is doing this incredibly evil performance? It's marvellously, wonderfully evil, but I can't. Gary Oldman, everybody. If you go and see Kung Fu Panda 2, the villain is played by Gary Oldman, which is why you can't quite pin it down, because he's thrown himself into this project with the enthusiasm in which he throws himself into every project. And so you can't quite pin his voice down. Brilliant. It's a really good movie, actually. Really good.
And once commented, oh, Gary Goldman did a good turn as the villain here, and your response was, he always does a good turn as the villain.
Yes, yeah, he's brilliant. He's brilliant, as usual. So, you know, not much of a surprise, but it's good to be there. And it really brings the movie into a different level. I think that I would be amazed if there wasn't at some point. I mean, Kung Fu Panda 3 is not that old. It's about 2 years old. If there's not another Kung Fu Panda movie, I'd be very much surprised, because it's a Kung Fu movie and you can just make more Kung Fu movies and what have you. So it's. I mean, this is not to detract from the marvellous performance of Ian McShane as the villain in the first one. So, you know, the Kung Fu Panda has generally had the good villains. I haven't seen Kung Fu Panda 3 as often, so I can't remember who's the villain in that, but it was perfectly fine. That's the thing. Kung Fu Panda is like Fast and Furious, isn't it? One comes out, it's like, the next one will be perfectly fine. It's going to be fine. Which is exactly the same with Fast and Furious. Not so much with The Hangover, definitely not with The Smurfs, but Pixar. So far, safe bets dominate the lower half of the top 10. And I guess if the studios could have that every year, it's like, yeah, the bottom half of the list is just safe bets. I bet they would. So this must have been quite a good year for these guys. At number 5... I think maybe this was a bit of a surprise that it did this well to the studio. I think they were kind of, well, again, I think they were aiming for that bottom half, bottom half of the list, safe bet area, if they could possibly make it. Because we have Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which made a large amount of money, large enough to put them at number 5 in the top 10 in 2011. You've got a love for the Mission Impossible franchise.
I do. It's not one I set out to cultivate. And indeed, if I was thinking of getting into it, I would look at Tom Cruise is super spy. Do I really want to get this franchise? Probably not. But by some strange reason, I just kind of drifted into it. And it's strangely addictive. And I was kind of surprised that they were still pushing them out. You seem to get reinvigorated in Mission Impossible. Was it Mission Impossible 3 when he worked with J.J. Abrams?
Yes.
And ever since then, it seemed to completely reinvigorate the franchise, because I thought, oh, that's the trilogy. He's got his wife figure, and then here we are in Ghost Protocol. And there's an awkwardness about the sudden absence of the wifely figure in this film, which tries to kind of step around. But it's like, yeah, it's here it is again, and it's another perfectly acceptable globe-trotting, stunt-filled espionage caper. And again, I only have one complaint about the franchise, and that's they called it Mission Impossible. If they just called it Tom Cruise Super Spy, I'd probably feel happy about it. As it is, they've shut the door on ever actually making a film about a quite popular TV series from the 60s. But oh well, small sacrifices.
Well, I think that one of the things about that is that, one, to a certain extent, because Mission Impossible, the series, had this kind of thing of like, well, the mission has to be impossible, and it has to be not impossible. I mean, it's impossible to say that Mission Impossible, the series, was like a precursor to things like House, where it's like every week you have something where it's a problem that seems intractable, and then they tract the intractable problem. And is that really...
Well, no, it's a long con, but it's a long con with some sort of Banana Republic somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. It's all about using brains instead of broad. So to be fair, it's more of a television format these days. I mean, you could have made a movie of it a long time ago, back when they did in fact not make a movie. I mean, that's the thing, people have warmed to the franchise as the franchise has become more suited to what the cinema is now. Like, when it was when I remember people not really liking the first two generally, because they felt it was dumbing down, whereas now they like it because this is what cinema is. Dumber. No, I mean,
well, you say dumbing down, but the first Mission Impossible film was famous for having a plot that was very hard to follow.
But yeah, but it was still not.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was more action. I mean, also, you just have to accept that Tom Cruise is one of the most. Yeah, his character, Ethan Hawke, is one of the most amazing human beings ever created, ever. He's a superhero level man. And once you can get over that slight ego trip for Tom Cruise and just swim with it, it's fine.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. Go you, Mission Impossible at number 5. Now, in the top 4, we have one of two entries in the top 4 that have the word part as a section of their title. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our listeners, such as they are, for their kindness and generosity, because we made the statement in the last season that if enough people asked us to, we would actually sit down and give the Twilight Saga a fair crack of the whip. We haven't heard a peep, so thank you very much, everybody. That's several hours of our life that we have still had remained intact for us right now. But enough ticket sales, $725 million worth of ticket sales, say that many people were not so fortunate and so went to see Breaking Dawn Part 1 of the Twilight Saga in 2011. It was around about that time.
Well, you know, even though Twilight has its many detractors, no one's really arguing that Twilight also has its many, many fans.
I mean, I think what we need to do is sit on our lofty perch here in 2018 and say, well, that kind of happened, didn't it?
Well, you know, we're not the target audience. In the day, you don't like Twilight, don't go and see Twilight. It no, came and went. Well, that's it. It was everywhere.
That is the point. It came and it went. I think, I don't know, I can only view this from the ones that I like, the angle of the ones that I like, which are, incidentally, I think the only other ones that actually got to get finished, which are The Hunger Games, which is kind of like the Rolling Stones to the Twilight Saga's Beatles, and The Maze Runner, both of which got a fair crack of the whip, whereas all the others went through various trials and tribulations, much like an under 20-year-old, you know, teenager in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, except that these are all the ones that made it to the end, as opposed to the ones that died horribly, with only one or even two movies in the franchise. And I think that The Hunger Games has similarly come and disappeared. I mean, people don't look back on The Hunger Games and go, oh, I wish there was more of that. It's an interesting thing, this idea of a finite franchise, that when it's over, it's kind of over. Like, there's no more, there is there, and there was no more tale to tell. Which stands in stark contrast to things like Lord of the Rings and something else, which we're going to mention later in the show.
Well, you know, there was the fans obviously had a great time speculating about how they were going to put this into film and who they were going to cast as what, and all that was over and it was done, and that's it. There isn't really any more material of this universe left to develop whatsoever. There's not even a hint of a spin-off. It's this, the love story runs its course. She becomes a vampire. Well, not at this stage, obviously, but, you know, the story is done and nothing else has been written. I mean, certainly, I forget the author's name, would have been offered a stack of money to write something else in
Stephanie
that universe.
Mayer.
Stephanie Mayer. But she hasn't really done that, really. She's tried it once. She was going to rewrite the first novel just to be from Edward's perspective, but apparently the manuscript got leaked, so she said stuff that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's. I think, to be honest, it is one of those things where it becomes a bit of a millstone around the author's neck, so, you know.
Well, the thing is, we're going to get to Harry Potter later. In fact, fairly soon, actually. Yes. So maybe I'll just leave it for then.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk instead about another thing that's become a millstone around somebody's neck, although I'm not sure quite whose. Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides is the sequel nobody asked for to the Pirates of the Caribbean trilogy. A truly awful movie that somehow managed to pull in $1 billion at the global box office.
And this is why we had a fifth one.
Yes, which I haven't even pressed play on it. It's like, what is the point, really?
It's a very strange thing where, you know, it feels like the people making it don't really want to be making it, and Johnny Depp doesn't want to be making it, and it feels like most of the audience don't want to go see it. So why are we doing it? It's like when those relationships where neither people are polite enough to come out and admit they both want it to end, so they're both staying in it for the other person. That's what the Pirates franchise has become. This one, yes, very underwhelming. You know, I got to be a great fan of Geoffrey Rush from the first films, because I didn't really know him as an actor, and suddenly he was one of my favourite characters in the franchise. And this one, they maim him and turn him into a British officer, naval officer. I was like, this is a sudden change of direction for this character, and he's now going to be permanently one-legged, hobbling around his wooden leg for every subsequent film after this as well. Oh, he's less interesting now for some reason. Now he's no longer a pirate.
Yeah. I don't even really remember. I remember that they are Ooh Mermaids. Yeah. In fact, that could be the subtitle of this movie. Pirates of the Caribbean, Ooh Mermaids.
Yes, a strange subplot with a mermaid and a pastor or something, wasn't there? A reverend, yeah, or something like that. And she seems to seduce and lead off in the waters. That was a fine subplot. I'm not quite sure what it had to do with anything, though.
I mean, the thing is, right, I've related before how you can't watch the Pirates of the... You can watch any one of the Pirates of the Caribbean original trilogy by itself and go, ah, it was piratey, and off you go. But then if you try and watch them stacked up, by the end it is like someone screaming the word pirates into your face over and over again. And you're feeling, you know, you can feel the spit hitting your face because they're really bellowing. And Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides manages to pack the moment where you feel like you've got some red-faced lunatic screaming the word pirates in your face within the first 25 minutes. So then the rest of the movie, you're just sitting there waiting for it to end, which I think is some kind of achievement.
We've still got one more of these suckers to go. Is there anything you particularly want to say or unpack about this movie whatsoever?
I can't, right, I'll tell you honestly, I remember the beginning, I was like, okay, maybe it'll just be it's really hard to tell. This is one of the things, if you were thinking of something that was critic proof, this is kind of it, and I think it gives you an important, I mean, we've got a lot of critic proof stuff here. Cars 2, critic proof. Smurfs, definitely critic proof. Hangover Part 2, critic proof. Fast 5, critic proof. Kung Fu Panda 2, no, actually that was quite well reviewed, people quite liked that. Mission Impossible, people quite liked that, but I think people were down on it to begin with, so like, or at least they thought, what's the point of this, and isn't he getting a bit old now? But yeah, it's in fact the reverse, he actually managed to warm people up to it, so that's brilliant. Twilight Saga, critic proof. I mean, now I come to look at it, I mean, there's only two or three movies on this top 10 that aren't movies that are going to be popular, despite the fact that critics are basically screaming at you not to go and watch them. Like, almost every entry, the ones that I would identify as being the reverse of that are Kung Fu Panda, Mission Impossible, and the top one, which, you know, you've kind of spoiled now, which is Harry Potter. But other than those, I mean, people could be looking at Wikipedia while they're listening to the podcast. That could spoil it. But, you know, maybe there are some people. But anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that every other movie on this list is something that they would say, on balance, you probably don't want to go and watch this. And yet people did. And Pirates of the Caribbean broke it. Yeah, speaking of which.
Oh, my. Dark of the Moon.
Yes.
What's not Dark Side of the Moon, not in the darkness of the moon, or Dark of the Moon? It always struck me as a very mangled sentence. But hey, look at this, Transformers. That's 80s, isn't it?
Yeah, I think possibly an early draft of the script was like someone accidentally typed on the title page, Transformers : Side, Dark of the Moon. I went, what's the word side doing there? And crossed it out, because they just transposed the two words. And then they went, okay, we'll look at Transformers Dark of the Moon, everybody. That's what we're making today. Because that's how Michael Bay likes to roll. Like, everybody turns up like, we're making the new Transformers movie. It's called Transformers something. So they all turn up on the first day, hand out the script. It's called Dark of the Moon, everybody. And they were 3 weeks into production before someone said, no, I just transposed the two words. It was supposed to be Dark. So I was like, too late now. You know, that just typifies the Transformers production ethic. Really, this is the...
I saw the first Transformers film. I walked out of there going, what the hell was that? That was awful in ways I couldn't possibly predict it, and was quite incoherent. This one, from what I've heard from the internet, armchair bashing of this film, is even more incomprehensible than lunatic, and just a jumble of things seemingly sewn together with no idea what the word cohesion or logic might mean. I'm very glad to have sat this out and not tainted my love of Transformers with it. But, oh, look, it made a shed ton of money. So we were stuck with this Transformers franchise for much longer.
I mean, yeah, you might have to break out, of course, because this is the last time in this franchise. So you might have to break out somewhere in this conversation. The Shia LaBeouf noise, because Mr. LaBeouf was... There for the last time. This is like directly prior to his traumatic breakdown and his you know, do it phase, that part of his life. So yeah, this is the Transformers movie that broke Shia LaBeouf. In the sense of not broke him as in made people know who he was, but the one that now that everybody knew who he was made them hate him so much he went and sat in a cinema and punished himself by watching all his movies back to back and filming it so that people could see him go, oh, I understand why people don't like me now. Yeah, it's I mean, it's actually
I've told this story before, I'll quickly relay it again. The guy who does the voice of Optimus Prime was very much into his character. He sort of voices him like a John Wayne kind of a guy. And he even asked for rewrites during the animated series when Optimus Prime wasn't being heroic enough. He always had to do the right thing, had to be this idealized father figure to the Autobots. Yes? But so, like, Optimus Prime would never seem to be cowardly or do anything unheroic. He was always a voice of reason and mercy and decency. Until we get to Transformers, this third Transformers film, where for a paycheck, he will not only have Optimus Prime dismember Megatron with his bare hands, but when another one of his fellow Autobots, who portrayed him in the film, is on his knees begging for mercy with all the Decepticons dead, Optimus Prime takes his gun and caps him in the head!
So,
what?
Well, what happens with Optimus Prime is, the obvious answer is, Michael Bay. I mean, to be good, the good thing about this is that we don't really have to belabor the Michael Bay point going forward. I think this was kind of the high point of the reign of Bay, and we've talked about it enough in the past. But talking of people who will cap their friends in the ass for a paycheck, you've seen Dark of the Moon, haven't you, Justin?
Yes, and that's why I've traveled across time and space to talk about it. Because I love the franchise. Oh, I love Michael Bay.
It's a sort of, the funny thing about this is we did this as a surprise at the end of the 2010 Top 10 show. When, oh, look who it is. It's Justin. And I swear, if you are listening to this and you do not know us, we didn't plan this. Justin's just like going, yeah, I'm parachuting in. And he's managed to do it at the exact same point in the Top 10. So...
I was sitting there this morning thinking, we're going to go a whole season with no Justin. That's really sad.
And ready to save the day and to do exactly the same pair of shows as well. So you're ready to join us for a little consideration of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which with $1.3 billion was the top of the box office in 2011. And seeing as you're the guest who's arrived at the party right now, Justin, we're going to ask you, how did you feel about the conclusion of the Harry Potter strand of the World of Magic franchise?
I thought it's very satisfactory. I think that with the books, I'm very much kind of firmly in. I put the books first, and I love the books, and the films are kind of subsidiary. But they do get better towards the end, and so I thought splitting the two films. The book into two films made a lot of sense. And the second half is the one where all the fun happens, right? So there's a lot of kind of exposition and stuff in part one. But part two, you've got, you know, it literally kicks off and everything. We got dragons and minecart rides and, you know, everything, big battles. So I thoroughly enjoyed this. And I think more than the books, you get a better sense of the payoff of all the previous films. There's the little touches of, you know, like the items and the Horcruxes and, you know, all these little things have been building and building, all these little stuff that you've seen on screen incidentally. And here we are, we have it all, the conclusion. So, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean, it's a big franchise, you know, kind of a beast of one. But it goes out with a bang.
I have to say that from my point of view, I've only seen it the one time when I went to see it because it was the end of the Harry Potter franchise, and you know, you pretty much had to go and see it. But I think I probably need to sit down and watch it again. I think if you're that kind of viewer, you'll come out and you go, "Well, that was fun." But looking back, it's like, I definitely need to unpick that. I think, in a certain way, because, and this is possibly why the part one, part two thing has mostly been, they've gone, "Oh no, we don't do that anymore." It's because if you're thinking, "Oh, I'm going to watch Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows part two," you think, "Oh, maybe I'll start with Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows part one." And as discussed in the 2010 show, you get to go, "Oh, I feel a bit bummed out now. Maybe I'll just go to bed." And that's, it's weird. It's,
yeah, I know. It's really,
I mean, it's fine, but it is really depressing. I mean, that whole show about that top 10 was depressed children in 2010. Whereas this one, as I've just, we were just saying, to bring it up, has been, with the exception of Harry Potter, Kung Fu Panda, and Mission Impossible, has been entirely made up of critic-proof movies. That is, if you look at the top 10, which you're probably not, but you can listen back to the show and you'll be like, "Wow, people went to see that?"
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah, Transformers, Pirates of the Caribbean, Twilight, Fast Five. It's all things critics would tell you not to go and see. And so this year, I mean, that's, I hadn't really put that together until we had this conversation. Ian, your thoughts on Deathly Hallows Part 2?
Well, not so much of a controversy, but a commentary that was made at the time. People read the seventh book, and they said the ending was very cinematic, particularly the confrontation between Harry and Voldemort, where Harry actually goes into the final fight fairly cool. You know, he re-displays his total dominance over the situation. Basically, tells Voldemort exactly how he's going to beat him, and Voldemort can't believe it, so he still casts his spell anyway, and Harry rebounds it, and that's that, and that was done. When we get to the movie, we don't get that big epic speech, which surprised everybody. Instead, what we get is Wizard Thunderdome. Two wizards enter, one wizard leave. And they literally just out-magic each other until one dies by just zap. There's no spells. It's just, I have a red beam, you have a green beam, we have a tug of war. Oh, you lost, you died. So everyone was quite surprised just how kind of, you know, zap the ending was in terms of the showdown with Voldemort. It's very brutal. Lots of people die.
Potter.
Some characters are introduced. It is. It's very brutal. I think it's satisfying enough. I've got a problem now. My niece is starting to watch the Harry Potter films. She's got through to four, and then they've put a pause on it because she's only 9 years old. And the first few films, it's like Christmas, that first Harry Potter film.
Oh, yeah,
It's a marvellously fun film for kids to watch. But then you get to, like, you know, Harry Potter's classmates getting murdered and Voldemort being at loose. And afterwards you just go, it just gets darker and more nasty. Yeah. You know, magic Nazis are everywhere and they've taken control and they're murdering people. And they're getting away with it for several films back to back. And in this one, it's like the absolute lunatics. They're murdering school children. Blatantly. It's like, what? So, she's got to wait a few years before she finds out the thrilling conclusion.
I think that that's definitely a good point. I mean, Harry Potter, this is one of the reasons why when I went to see Fantastic Beasts, the first one, and I'm immensely looking forward to the new Fantastic Beasts coming up very soon, is that It knows where it's starting. It goes, right, well, this is the world of magic. We're going to start here. And therefore, it feels a lot more integrated in the sense, like you say, like you can stuff on, you know, Harry Potter and Philosopher's or Sorcerer's Stone, depending on whether you're on one side of the Atlantic or the other, or Harry Potter and Chamber of Secrets, or even Prisoner of Azkaban, and just have a jolly good time for a little bit. And then after that, it starts to get into a different sort of tonal area. Yesterday, across the globe, Netflix released its gritty reboot of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which, if you watch the advert for that, has exactly the same problem. You're watching that going, well, I don't see how that's not going to be a tonal mess. Because on the one hand, it's all, I'm a teenager who likes to go to parties. On the other hand, it's like, hail Satan. No, really, hail Satan. Let's get some sacrifice going on. It's like, which world do I choose? It's like, well, I don't really know what to tell you if you haven't got a clear, you know, if you're not like, I really like sacrificing goats or I really like going to keggers. I'm not sure what to tell you. If you're like, well, I kind of like doing both. And Harry Potter has the same thing across the franchise, that some films are definitely like, oh, this is a bit grim. And then the other films are like, oh, no, but this is lovely to watch at Christmas. And it just is a product of what Harry Potter is that happens. Whereas Fantastic Beasts is a lot more like, it's a magical romp with the seeds of magical Nazis to come, and yes, that works out perfectly well. But that has brought us through the top 10 of 2011, and like I say, I am amazed, not to say disheartened, to note, I mean, because I think that the MCU movies, which we talked about briefly at the beginning, are more, well, definitely more warmly regarded. Going back, some people are not keen on Thor, and some people, weird that they are not keen on the Captain America movie. But generally speaking, the feeling of these movies is that they're good movies and they're part of the thing, and they're kind of lumped in like everyone's a winner, like that whole general, basically the worst MCU movie is still a hell of a good time. Whereas our top 10 is littered yeah. with stuff that people are like, you know, oh, are you really getting a sequel to Cars? Why the hell are they making a Smurfs movie? Why is there a sequel to The Hangover? Are we really doing a fifth Fast and the Furious movie? What the hell with the Pirates of the Caribbean? We had a trilogy. Can't you just leave it? Oh, not more Michael Bay Transformers, but I suppose this is the third one, so at least there won't be any more. Oh, dear. You know, and Twilight, you know, what do we even want to say? That's what we had in 2011. You know, it wasn't good.
They're all prequels. They're all sequels, aren't they? Every single one of them is franchise.
So it is franchise-tastic 2011. So, yes, thank you for joining us, I think I would say. Your feelings on 2011, Ian?
My feelings? Well, just looking over what had a legacy here. Mission Impossible's still going. Harry Potter has regenerated itself. Transformers is kind of now doing a prequel reboot, with its Transformers now looking a lot more like the classic toys. So it's actually, it's lurched back to the 80s to reinvent itself. I think everything, Fast and the Furious is still ongoing as well. So it's surprising how many, it's amazing how many things here are still kind of lingering, really. And what's died off doesn't really surprise us.
Well, I'm not sure that those Smurfs won't be back again. Although the good thing for Columbia is that the Smurfs are definitely like, well, we'll do one, and then the next one will get a cinema release if that makes money. And then if that one makes money, we'll keep going with that. But then when it comes time to go straight to DVD, we have no guilt about that. We'll just pump those Smurfs movies out. We'll have all the character models. So why do all the Smurfs sound different, Mummy? Because this is straight to DVD and they can't afford expensive actors, darling.
Justin, perhaps we should quickly swing round to you and make you do a quick pass on Cars 2 and Kung Fu Panda, because you're Mr. Wonderful Art Animation Guy.
Yeah, I've got a lot of love for the Kung Fu Panda. Very good character. Yeah, they're all pretty consistent, I seem to remember. I'm just looking generally at kind of 2011 now. It's a very interesting collection.
Yeah,
of top 10
it is.
Films
it's
there.
Not.
It's the ones that I was interested in.
Yeah, there's a lot of them in part two. Oh, well done, Justin. You're not with us that often, but when you are, you know how to bring in a segue. Yeah, part two is going to be a lot more. I mean, obviously, we're going to keep it 80s-centric, but we will briefly glance over things. The interesting films of 2011 did not, it seems, or like, interesting in the sense of, that's an interesting cultural moment, did not happen in the top 10. The top 10 was all pretty safe, really, in terms of what people were putting out there, and indeed it made its money. But I think the things that may have had more of an effect, or should have had more of an effect, they weren't in this top 10. And what were those things, people are asking at home? Well, you will find out in the next show. What an amazing lead-off. So for now, for me, you know, I'm going to say, if people are like, why are you making a second sequel to that Revenge of the 80s Kids thing? The second sequel didn't make nearly as much money at the box office. Where might you go to explain to them that we've never made any money? Where might people go to be told that?
Well, Leo, one place they could go would be our Facebook page. You can find our Facebook page at facebook.com /Revenge of the 80s Kids. And that's 80s as in numbers, so 80s. But podcasts are what it's all about, and to find a full archive stretching back from the very dawn of time, all you have to do is point your web browser at the 80s Kids, and that's 80s as in word, .blogspot.com. Once there, you'll be able to subscribe using the podcast aggregator of your choice, or stream and download individual episodes direct to your PC for dark reasons of your own. If people want to subscribe directly to the cast, Leo, how might they do that?
Well, Ian, all they have to do is set up a new feed in their podcast aggregator and point it to feeds.feedburner.com/Revenge of the 80s Kids, and that's 80s as in numbers again, so 80s. If people are so impressed by the audio they've heard today, they would consider offering their support on Patreon to make the world of the 80s Kids brighter still. They could check out our Patreon campaign at patreon.com/the 80s Kids, and that's 80s the word.
And of course, we have Justin with us today, so he's going to have to explain for himself. He doesn't have people to do this because he's not that kind of guy. Where can people find you, Justin, on the internet?
You can find me on my website, justindoodler.com, which has lots of examples of my illustrative work.
So there we go. And is some of that work... Is some of that work nostalgic for 2011?
2011. Well, it's
Pirates. Okay, fair enough. There we go. Good. Right. So that answers that question. So yes, that was all for part one of 2011. Farewell.
I'm just going to often research which part of the Sabrina the Teenage Witch fandom was advocating for a gritty remake and how they rose to power. Until then, farewell.
I'm going to prepare for another entrance where I turn up at the last minute. So, bye.
Bye.